This is Rebecca from New Haven, Connecticut. You are listening to WNHH Community Radio 103.5 FM.
Welcome to Book Talk, where we talk about books. I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and today we'll be talking about the brand new novel Spoonbenders, first with the author, Daryl Gregory, and then with my guests, Tui Sutherland and Alfie Guy. And stay tuned at the end of the show for a middle grade recommendation from one of our friendly New Haven librarians. These are the characters of Spoonbenders: Buddy, who can see the future, Frankie, who can move things with his mind, Irene, who always knows when anyone is lying, and Maddie, who can travel outside his body. And then there's Teddy, the patriarch, the con man. This is the amazing Telemachus family, whose powers haven't stopped them from being racked with debt, disfigurement, and loss. This is the amazing Telemachus family, shattered, splintered, struggling. As the end of the world as we know it approaches, at least according to Buddy, they have to ask themselves, where did it all go wrong? When did a gift become a curse? And how much can you change the truth just by how you tell the story? I had the opportunity to speak with author Daryl Gregory last week, and I'd like to share that interview with you now. Daryl Gregory grew up in Chicago and now lives in Oakland, California. He is the author of multiple science fiction and fantasy stories, novellas, and novels, as well as the writer of the comic books Dracula, Company of Monsters, and Planet of the Apes. He has no supernatural powers that I know of. Daryl, thanks so much for joining me today on Book Talk on WNHH Community Radio 103.5 FM.
Thanks for having me, Sid. It's great to be here.
Do you, in fact, have any supernatural powers?
No, I often get asked which superpower I would want, though. And I always fall back to my childhood one. I want to be able to teleport. Maybe I just want to avoid planes for the rest of my life.
I read A Wrinkle in Time when I was, you know, probably 7. And so I always wanted to be able to tesseract, which is basically the same thing.
Right. Oh, I love that book.
A great book. So, Daryl, in my intro, I characterized you as a fantasy and science fiction writer. But what struck me about Spoonbenders was how much it seemed to transcend genre, that even though there are elements of sci-fi or fantasy about it, these characters do have these supernatural powers, the novel is grounded in a time and a place that feels really solidly realistic. And I guess the themes that the novel is concerned with, things like family and loss, identity, the degree to which we control our own destinies, those feel to me like themes we expect to be addressed by literary fiction, but we don't usually expect from sci-fi or fantasy. So I guess I wanted to start with several questions for you, and you can take them in whatever order you want. Do you characterize yourself as a sci-fi and fantasy writer? And if you do, did you feel like this novel was a departure for you, or am I being unfair to the genre?
Oh, I think you're being unfair to the genre. You know, this past week I've been at a writer's workshop where I've been, it's 6 weeks long, and they have a different teacher every week. And I was teaching the first week, and I was teaching these students. And I mean, the overwhelming lesson is story, humans are humans. And every story has to be rooted in, you know, people's wants and desires, what they're trying to do, what they're struggling with. And a lot of times when people first start to write in any genre, the hard part is getting to the personal stuff, the stuff that matters to you a lot. And so I don't see any difference in Spoonbenders from anything else I've written. A lot of times genre is a matter of marketing, right?
Yes.
So it's a lot of times it's we're going to put it in this section of the bookstore because these books are more like each other than those other books over there. But, you know, I've always written my stories have to pass the mom test, something we were talking about briefly, where my mom has never read science fiction and fantasy, but I make sure that every book I write, there's nothing required from outside the book. She can follow along because the characters are realistic, because they want things you understand, even as weird things are happening. So, you know, in Spoonbenders, it's about a family who has psychic powers, and they're not very powerful, and they've never made a dime off them really, but they were famous for briefly in the 70s, and now they're just living at the novel set in 1995 in Chicago, and now they're living sort of 20 years after whatever fame they whatever they had has dissipated. And, you know, and a lot of it's rooted in, you know, I grew up in Chicago. I know the suburbs. And these people are not exactly my family, but they're like a lot of families I grew up with and was kind of envious of. They were loud, boisterous people who seem much more exciting than my family. And I tell these writers that, you know, it doesn't matter what genre you're writing in. It has to be based in characters you understand who are trying to do things that you understand.
So can you talk maybe a little bit about why those elements of the supernatural appeal to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one, there's just something happening at the DNA level where I love stories where something weird is happening. Some strange bit of, you know, business intrudes on the world and disturbs what would be a static, boring life. I love that feeling that things are about to get very, very strange. And science fiction has advantages in that you can make metaphors, you know, you can make them concrete. And like, Irene, the mom in the story, she's a human lie detector. And she just knows when, as soon as someone speaks, if they're deliberately telling a lie, she knows it. And she's got a teenage son. So this just makes it hell. You know, all of us think our moms have this power.
Right.
And so to have to navigate, like, how do you talk to your mom without spilling the beans, without her figuring out what's going on, just strikes me as that's exactly what it feels like to be a teenager sort of walking that minefield. Yeah. And so, yeah, you have this ability when you allow the strange in. It can be both real and interesting that what would it be like if this actually existed. But the parallels are there. The emotion has to be tied to it or the story doesn't work for me.
Yeah, totally. Well, almost a year ago, I guess, I had on the author Bob Prohl, who wrote a great book called 100,000 Worlds, which is in large part set in comic book conventions. And so I was very schooled by this book in the art of comics, which I also don't tend to read. And I learned all about the idea of origin stories and how all comic book heroes have an origin story. So I thought that was that would be interesting to hear from you about the origin story of the amazing Telemachus family, where this idea kind of came to you and how they all started.
You know, I have a bunch of different origin stories that I change depending on who I'm talking to. If I'm talking to someone who knows Chicago a little bit, I say it comes from a deep personal wound of being a Cubs fan because it's about that feeling of mediocrity. Like the Cubs, until recently, you know, the Cubs were, you just were a Cubs fan and you would start off with hope, but you just knew they'd be mathematically eliminated from the playoffs, you know, by Labor Day. And so your whole life was thinking, well, this is the way the universe works. You show up, you do your job, and you're probably going to fail, and then you try to come back next season. And so I was really interested in this idea of, you know, in really old science fiction, like let's say 1950s, golden age, 60s science fiction, somebody with superpowers would be – they'd be like a superhero, that they'd be doing amazing things with this. They may be in control of the world. There's a classic book from the 40s called Slan, in which the telepathic people are in control of the entire world. So that story's been told, but I was really interested in what would happen in the real world where these powers are not that reliable. And not that useful either. I mean, I was taking Uri Geller as a model, and I was thinking, besides trying to amaze people on stage, we don't have much use for Bette cutlery. Like, you don't think, gee, I wish there was just a way to have this spoon bend without me just picking it up and bending it. And that kind of level I just found really interesting. Like, what do you do when life just hasn't turned out? So, and there's kind of an origin story in the book in that Maddie, who's 14 years old, who believes, you know, that all the good stuff happened 20 years ago before he was born. He has his powers sort of come to life in an embarrassing way, but he realizes, oh, I may be one of the family. Like, I may be one of these amazing Telemachuses who used to be famous. And he's, you know, he grew up feeling like the circus had already left town and maybe there's hope again. And so it starts off with basically being his origin story. And then we get the story of the entire family and what they've been doing now and what they're struggling with now.
And did the family themselves come to you kind of full-fledged? Like, did you know how many of them there would be and what power each of them would have? Or how did that work out in the evolution of the writing, I guess?
6 months, I did nothing but talk to myself on paper about what could happen in this book. I wanted to, by the time I started writing, I wanted to know who was in the family, what their powers might be, and how, you know, what interesting things I could say about them. And so there was just a lot of just me writing in my notebook, thinking about these characters, and they gradually, you know, come into focus. And so I was really happy about that, because by the time I started writing, I sort of knew them in my head. And the way the book is structured is that there's each chapter is from a different family member's point of view. And so it's like starting five different books with five different, slightly different voices. And I wanted to, you know, have those voices in my pocket when I started writing. And so that was, it was just a long process of saying, you know, what if, what would be interesting? If somebody's way too powerful, for instance, let's say Irene could read everybody's mind, mm-hmm. We'd be into X-Men territory. It seemed much more interesting to have this small limited power where she could just tell if somebody was telling the truth or not, seemed more interesting by making it more limited. So it was that kind of winnowing process and just talking to myself about it.
Right. Buddy's kind of the same way. Like, he can see the future, but only kind of in these flashes and scenes, and he doesn't know the whole way everything is going to unfold, which is more interesting than him just being able to tell you exactly what's going to happen every day for the next number of years.
And, yeah, exactly. And he's sort of haunted by, you know, he both wants to know and doesn't want to know. Like, if there's something terrible, he doesn't want to know what it is. But if he knows something is happening, he's sort of locked in because he's terrified of, if he doesn't do the thing that he can remember the future as well as the past. So if he doesn't do this thing that he remembers doing in the future, when it comes time to do it, he's not sure if he has free will or not. There's a line in there where Buddy's walking around the neighborhood and he's having to follow the script that he remembers doing. And he thinks to himself that duty eats free will for breakfast. And what I liked about that was that's what life feels like a lot of times. You have duties, you have things you have to do, and you can feel like sometimes you have no choice and you just have to do them. And Buddy is driven by trying to protect his family.
Right. And that's exactly also what I meant about, like, the way this book operates on both that literal and metaphorical level, that, you know, literally he's doing these things he remembers in the future. And on a metaphorical level, like, we all completely know that feeling of feeling like you have to do the things you know you have to do.
Right, exactly.
So I want to talk to you a little bit more about the mechanics of writing a book like this, specifically a little bit about how you write a book with an ending that is as complicated as this one. As we talked about a little bit, Buddy has had this vision of the future that throughout the book he's in the process of preparing for. And we, like the rest of the characters, don't understand the nature or the purpose of his preparations until the very end. So when you are doing that, when you're writing through this, do you know from the very beginning exactly what the end is going to be? Have you figured out the whole plot before you even start writing? And does that change once you start the actual writing?
Right. You know, it's funny. I was just talking to these students at this workshop this week saying, you know, you're always writing for the ending. You may not know the ending exactly when you start, but once you figure out what the ending is, it's incumbent upon you to structure the book so that the promise of that ending, the promise of it is set in the beginning of the book. So sometimes you have to discover, once you figure out what the ending is, you have to go and rewrite the beginning so it captures the thing that you're going to be pointing for. Because I'm really very much into, you know, can you make the story as well-structured in retrospect? Like, it can look like you're just following the characters doing what they want to do. But when you get to the ending, you realize, oh, there was so much that was set up, like that feeling. It may be a feeling, it may be plot elements that you've set up in the beginning. So for me, I don't start stories anymore until at least I know an ending. So I used to, when I used to write a lot of short stories, I would just start writing. I would have an idea. I'd start writing and I'd immediately sort of hit a wall where I realized I didn't know where the story was supposed to go. I didn't know what this meant for the characters, and it would sort of paralyze me. And then I would start another story and I'd run into that wall again. So now what I do is I take my time and I just ruminate. And like I said, for this book, it was 6 months, and I knew that I wanted to have an ending that was like those Shakespeare farces. I wanted to have something like Much Ado About Nothing, when there's many plot lines going on and then everything sort of all gets settled. All the plot lines converge at the country house in the, you know, in the last act, and that's the kind of book I wanted. And so, once I knew I wanted, that's the kind of ending I wanted. Once I figured out what I sort of what I wanted to have happen in that ending, then it was going back to the outline and trying to figure out how can I make all of this work out. And have you not noticed that there's all these plot lines sort of building and building, and then when they all converge, have it be sort of a happy surprise? So that was a lot of the work of the novel, actually, is trying to, once I figured out what the ending was, then going and making sure that everything pointed toward that.
Right, which I think really worked. I mean, it is exactly what you said. Like, at the end, there's this big denouement, and you're kind of like, oh, that's what everything meant when I read it earlier, which I didn't realize, because it's not so pointed that you feel like the surprise is already taken away. But in the end, it all makes sense.
Right, yeah, and it has to be, you know, the funny thing is that it has to, when you're doing these kind of plot things that you're going to pay off, or these character moments, this, like, a problem Irene has is that she trusts no one because she knows when they're lying to her. You know, I knew that the arc of the story for Irene is that somehow she'd had to be able to find love, find someone that she can trust. And so once you know that that's the emotional arc you want to do, then you sort of have to go back and build in all the moments of the relationship. And it's just, and you keep writing and you keep rewriting and you pick the best moments that all build to that.
You mentioned that, you know, the book does follow this very formulaic structure, which, you know, there's a chapter per character and then it starts over again, goes back to the first character and goes through the five. Mm-hmm. Was it always that way? Did you always feel like the book was going to be written that way?
Yeah, I knew very early on, well, I didn't know, you know, right at the very beginning, but I knew I wanted to write about a family, and I knew I wanted to have everybody have their moment in the sun, because I wanted to talk about how families, even when they're disagreeing with each other and they're kind of dysfunctional, how they're actually, you know, looking out for each other. And I wanted to write about that kind of family. And so once I realized that I wanted every person to have their moment in the sun, I decided, oh, this is going to be one of those kind of novels where we rotate through the point of view and you get to see things from many angles. Sometimes the same event from a different person's point of view, and you learn something new that was hidden from even the other family members. So once I realized that was the structure, that sort of set the structure for me. So we have this carousel where we follow each person's point of view. And then the later chapters, as all the plot lines are converging, in the same chapter, we'll rotate through everybody's point of view. Like scene by scene by scene.
Right. Well, it's like the sense of acceleration.
Yeah, exactly. The carousel sort of speeds up. I wanted that sort of feeling that, like, oh my gosh, now the handing off of the baton of whose story it was, you realize that they're all enmeshed together. And yeah, I wanted that sense of velocity.
And then I noticed at the end, the direction reverses. And it is almost like that sense of, like, slowing down.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you noticed that. You know, I was having this conversation with my editor and we were talking about moving some scenes around. I said, oh, I really don't want to break the structure. And this is sort of like the duty eats free will for lunch. He was like, yeah, writers always care about structure more than the readers do. And we were having this friendly argument. I was like, I think even if readers don't realize what the structure is or how the structure is, there's this feeling of sometimes subconscious trust that, like, oh, this is the pattern, and then they start to expect the pattern. And then at the very end, yeah, I wanted to go in that reverse order because it starts with Maddie in the beginning and I wanted to end with Maddie. And so in the last chapter where we pick up the story a month after the big climax, I wanted to reverse the order, touch on everybody's lives, what they were doing in the month since and where they seem to be going in the future, and then end again with Maddie and have that kind of perfect circle.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think that often readers are not consciously deliberating on those things, but it nevertheless has an impact on the reading experience when you do things right with structure.
I was telling my students this week that, you know, there are certain stories that where it may not be the plot momentum, but sometimes just the structure. Like, for instance, if you have a story that's a list or an ABCD area where you're going to go, we're going to talk about, you know, fantastic animals that don't exist. And we're going to do, you know, A is for Oh, now I have to come up with
a fantastic animal.
It doesn't exist. But yeah, there's a momentum, like you want to see, well, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next in the list? And because you know the pattern and the structure, it's sort of like a jazz song that you can dance to, right? There's this steady beat and you know that's the structure. And if you have that steady structure, readers will relax into it and let you riff and play around because they know you're coming back to the beat. They know they can dance to it.
Totally. Did you ever think about writing those chapters in first person instead of in third?
Yeah, because I've written some novels in first and some in third. I think it was because very quickly I settled into third person because there's this sort of heightened, I just wanted the ability to be able to use language a little more differently, to be a little jazzier in the language, even for characters who might necessarily not be able to say exactly that. But I wanted it to be a little jazzier. I knew that was kind of the tone of the book. Yeah, I sort of settled into it. It's sort of a mysterious process when you start a novel or a short story. A lot of times the character and the whose point of view it is and whether it's first person or third sort of comes with the story idea. And I don't even know how to explain that, but it just seems like some stories feel like they should be told a certain way. And you have to sort of go with that instinct and try to figure out what it's doing for you. And sometimes I've had times when I've had to switch. I wrote a young adult novel and I had to switch the entire point of view from third person to first because I realized it was going to work better with that character's voice on every page.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I wanted to go back to something you said a little bit earlier about Irene and, you know, her arc in the book and, you know, she needs to find love specifically because I had been thinking about the time in which this novel takes place. And of course, Irene meets her boyfriend online, AOL online in a chat room, because the book is set in mainly between June and September 1995 with some flashbacks to things that happened earlier. And it's a time when the internet is in its infancy. And it does play a role here because of, you know, the Irene relationship. But there's no Google, there are no cell phones, there's no texting or Facebook or Twitter. And I've actually done a few books on the show that are set right around this time. Kate Reculia's novel, Bellwether Rhapsody, Rebecca Mackay's novel, 100 Year House. And so I wanted to ask you the same question that I asked those authors about their choice to set their story right at this time. Did you feel like it's a story that wouldn't be the same if it took place today?
Yeah, there was something about, especially Irene's story, when she realizes there's all these, you know, America Online CDs flying into the house. If, you know, in those years in the mid-90s, every time you open the mailbox, there was yet more 40 free hours.
Right, I remember that, actually.
Oh, my God. And, you know, there was this time when it was kind of mysterious. And for Irene's story, I really like this idea that she would at first be trying to keep her son off the internet. And then she goes on AOL and she realizes that in these chat rooms, she can't tell if someone's lying. They're not in front of her. And that lets her, for the first time, start talking to someone and have a relationship. And yeah, so that time period, I wanted it for Irene's story. I also wanted it for a plot reason, in that the Teddy Telemachus and Maureen, who are the patriarch and matriarch of the family, I wanted them to meet in the 60s when the government first started doing psi research. And these are real programs that we spent millions of dollars on. And all the government stuff actually exists. And Project Stargate, this bizarre thing that we sunk a lot of money into to compete with the Russians on telepathy and telekinesis, we funded it until 1995. And so there was something about, oh, if I set this in 1995, these people are the right ages to be falling in love in the 60s, and their children will be alive, and it worked out with Irene's story. And there was something weird about writing a period piece about a time period I've lived through. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm turning into, I had to actually go back and find screenshots of what AOL looked like. And thank God, and thanks to Google and people recorded screenshots of what AOL looked like and what the screens looked like. So I knew exactly what Irene was clicking on as she's discovering the world. So I couldn't remember exactly myself. I had to do research about a time period I'd lived through.
It's so funny. I had no idea that the government stuff that is in the book is real. Is that something you just happened to know?
Yeah, I'd heard about it for years, and I'd heard about Project Stargate, and I always thought it was this bizarre footnote. And then I started looking into it, and it just gets weirder and weirder. And some of these people are still on the lecture circuit who are part of that psi program still trying to teach people how to bend spoons and be clairvoyant. And yeah, and so I sort of knew about that, and then I dug deeper. And just a few months ago, from a Freedom of Information request, the CIA has put online all their documents from Project Stargate. So all the times they tested clairvoyance and they tested Uri Geller, all the notes and results are there up on the internet for people to read. It's bizarre that we spent so much time and money really believing in this stuff.
Well, that seems like the perfect note to end on, because now all the listeners can go and Google that and go read all of that, because who doesn't want to do that right now? Daryl, it has been awesome talking to you. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Sid. I really appreciate it.
I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM. I want to take a moment to introduce my guests, Tui Sutherland and Alfie Guy. Tui is the author of many books, including the best-selling Wings of Fire fantasy series. She last appeared on Book Talk discussing Val Emick's novel, The Reminders. Alfie is the director of the Yale Writing Center and teaches a class on science fiction at Yale. He last appeared on Book Talk talking about John Freeman Gill's The Gargoyle Hunters. Tui and Alfie, thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Sid.
I'm really excited to be here.
So, as I mentioned at the start of the show, almost all of the members of this family, the amazing Telemachus family, have real supernatural gifts. Buddy sees the future. Irene can tell if anyone is lying. Frankie can move objects with his mind. Maddie can travel outside his body. Even Frankie's little twin daughters can set things on fire. But Teddy, the patriarch, is the one member of the family who lacks any of these gifts. And I wanted to start by talking about what you guys thought of that choice, to make him the con man and not the person with real powers, why you think Daryl made that choice and how you think it operated.
I really liked it. I thought it was so cool that, I mean, I loved the development of Teddy and Maureen's relationship that we got to see in the flashbacks, and how, like, he thought she was faking from the beginning, and she saw right through him. Like, she knew that he was faking the whole time, but fell in love with him anyway. And he eventually, like, came to realize that she was real, even before even before it was confirmed by the little machine. I just thought that I feel like that's a really cool starting point for a family, to take, like, the world's most powerful psychic and then the world's best con man, and sort of see what kind of family they build from there.
I really like that, because you're emphasizing that Teddy does have skills, almost supernatural skills, but not quite. But it struck me that if Teddy is super powerful, he doesn't need any of the other characters. Whereas if he's just a schemer or a planner or a plotter, then he needs his specialists, sort of like the mastermind in a thief story. So it ends up generating more energy among the characters if Teddy, you know, he can be super smart, but if he can't see things at a distance or jump over buildings, then the plot needs more texture and complication. I think it makes for a much more interesting protagonist, because he can't get too many things done by himself.
Like, he needs Irene. I loved that he needed Irene to tell him who was lying to him when. That's like, he would sneak her into meetings with him just for that purpose.
Absolutely. And I loved what you said, Tui, about how he was in love with Maureen before he knew she was genuinely powerful. And then his feelings for her can take on this additional admiration and you know, respect and fondness, which I think makes their love have a little bit more softness to it.
But Alfie, do you really think that Teddy ends up using the members of his family to accomplish what he wants accomplished? I mean, I think that Frankie, more than anyone, is the person that we see doing that, right? Frankie is the one who uses his nephew Maddie to try to get the combination to the safe so he can steal the money that he owes to pay the mob. And he's the one who depends on Buddy to have this vision of the future that he's going to win at roulette, and again, earn enough money to pay off his debts. He's the one who, like, seems to, like, really rely on the members of his family to do that stuff. But I feel like Teddy, for the most part, gets done what he gets done or doesn't on his own, with maybe the exception of, you know, he does take Irene along to tell him if someone's lying, but it's more almost to, like, confirm his own suspicions. Like, I feel like he would kind of know without her. She's just his confirmation. But so much of what he manages to accomplish, you know, is through his own skills as a card shark, as a manipulator, as the con man who gets involved with the mob and thinks he can outmaneuver them and fails to do so. Like, that's all he kind of rises and falls on his own.
I think that's fair. I think what I said may have seemed to suggest he was manipulative. What I was trying to say is he doesn't have the supernatural skills. In some ways, I'm going to take what you're saying as agreeing with my deeper point, which is he's an interesting protagonist because he doesn't have magic to solve his problems. And I think you're right. I sort of slightly miscast him by saying he relies on them. I mostly meant he can't do it just through thinking it and then suddenly it's done. So we get to have plot instead of just events. So I think you're right. And I also think that this may be getting ahead of us, but when you say Frankie tries to use the powers to get things done, I think it's one of the reasons Frankie stuff always goes wrong. Like, I don't think this book is particularly in favor of using supernatural powers to achieve your goals. So I think you're, I think that's a very, very good correction you've given.
I mean, for me, I feel like one of the interesting things about Teddy's lack of supernatural powers is how much he seems exactly like the rest of his family who do have these supernatural powers. Like, you could imagine a scenario in which he is the outsider. He is the one who is different and set apart. And yet he seems like completely organically part of this in the way that he both sometimes finds success and sometimes his reliance on what he sees as his own skills is what gets him into trouble and what leaves him, maimed and alone sometimes, in debt, all of those things. And it mirrors the way that all of his children have these gifts, but sometimes by trying to rely on them or trying to use them, they also find themselves alone, in debt, feeling, in ways that you would not expect. You would expect that, like, people with these gifts, are able to solve things magically. And instead, their magic seems to create more problems than it solves. And for me, what was interesting was that line between the magical power and just sort of a normal everyday talent is really blurred.
Yeah, and I think that's really cool. I think I love the way he does that with the, everything feels like a bit of a metaphor for something that could really be going on. Like, I felt like a lot of their problems were caused, it seemed like they were caused by their magic, but it was really coming from their personalities. I kind of feel like Frankie would be in the same amount of trouble whether or not he was telekinetic, I think he'd make the same terrible choices. Right. And I kind of think Irene too, she can blame her troubles on her sort of lie detection powers, but in truth, like, she might be the kind of person who just pushes people away anyway.
Right. She's the kind of person who holds people to such high standards that everyone will always disappoint her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think when you call it a metaphor, I agree with that, Yutui. And I was also thinking that in some cases, the powers seem like natural extensions of personality. I'm basically just agreeing with what you're saying about Irene, that she seemed, with her powers, 100% credible to me. I feel like I have known people whose either suspicion or sensitivity was such that they were almost as good as lie detectors as this character who can do it magically.
Yeah, what's so interesting about her, there's that line where she talks about how her lie detection only works if the people she's interacting with know that they are lying, but that so often people believe the lies they're telling. And so in that instance, her powers of detection fail. And that also seemed like, that's any person, right? Who is generally good at detecting when someone is not telling them the truth. But when people believe what they're saying, it's much, much harder to know what's real and what isn't.
Wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say to something you said earlier, Sid, that I think kind of any good book about magic or superpowers will get into the problems that those cause. Like, I can't think of any where it's just like a good thing to have superpowers and you can solve all your problems, Like, I think that's what makes it interesting to write about them is to sort of get into the complications that arise when you take something and like lift it to another level of like the problems go up a level too.
Yeah. I mean, in this instance, do you feel like it is the gifts themselves that get them into trouble or what they do with it? I guess the question is, how much control do they themselves have over the choices that they're making?
Yeah, I think the most interesting one in that case is Buddy, because we talked a little about Irene and Frankie, and I think that it's not so much the gifts as it is their own personalities. But with Buddy, it's a lot more about his gift. And I found him the most interesting because I also wrote a character who can see the future. And it is really, it's difficult. I'm so curious to hear how Daryl did this, because it's difficult to try and write a book where one of your characters can see the end and not give it all away. I think he did a really good job of kind of leading towards that without ever like completely revealing what was going to happen.
Yeah, but, and I thought the way it was represented too, I mean, you're sort of saying the same thing, but the way it was represented was really emotionally satisfying, that basically Buddy has too much information, mm-hmm. and he gets unstuck in time because when he's having an experience, he doesn't know if it's in the timeline he's supposed to be in or something he's remembering or something he's predicting. And that made a natural limitation to what he could do with his prodigious power. And I found that so credible. Like often when someone has a power like this in a book, there has to be a really artificial constraint on why don't you just use that to solve this problem? And I felt like the way they represented Buddy being overwhelmed made a natural constraint on the problem, and one that was emotionally satisfying to me.
Dude, it actually reminds me of the book that you and I most recently discussed on the show, The Reminders, in which there is this 8-year-old girl who is born with the ability to remember absolutely everything that's happened to her. And on the show, Brian, our third reader, was talking about how he wondered, you know, when she gets to age 40 and has so many memories built up, how she'll kind of grapple with that, because, you know, as humans in the world, we filter out the things that we remember, and we remember the things that are important, and we kind of forget or compartmentalize the things that just didn't matter as much. But for someone where every memory is equally clear and you can't prioritize any of them, that's much harder to do. And Buddy is almost the inverse of her, you know, where he has all these future memories, and they're so overwhelming to him, he can't kind of figure out which ones are the important ones and which ones aren't, that he is just stuck in place.
Yeah, and I loved also, or sort of unmoored, I would say, actually, in time.
Yes.
I love how it was represented in the text by every time we got to a Buddy section, it was in the present, as opposed to all the others were told in past tense. You know, and for him, every moment is the present, kind of. I thought that was so well done. I really liked that sort of storytelling device. And I think it's also interesting because in a way, he's never living in the present. He's always, you know, because he's always kind of got so much else going on that he can't ever just be in the moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beautiful thing about the ending, is giving him that opportunity.
Yeah, I'm not trying to loop us back, but that reminds me, too, of when Sid said that Teddy doesn't really use or manipulate his kids, or at least not in the timeline that we're watching. He may have been wanting to exploit them earlier. And his role in the ending is basically to free Buddy from this power. He wants Buddy to be able to have a slightly more normal life. And, you know, that's why they essentially end his ability to always see the future, so he can live, you know, day to day.
Well, and that's so... Yeah, spoiler alert here for our listeners. If you haven't finished the book, go ahead and do that now. But but to talk about that moment at the ending where Buddy is shot with this microlepton gun that supposedly destroys the supernatural powers of any individual upon whom it is aimed. And it is a device that is created by Teddy and his partner, the amazing Archibald. When they're talking to Maddie about it later, he's like, is it real or is it fake? And they say, well, it's real and it's fake. Like, essentially, it's the placebo effect. You know, if you believe that it will destroy your powers, it actually does destroy your powers. And to me, that was really interesting because it circles back again to this question of, like, is there really a difference between what is real and what is fake? Like, are Teddy's con man powers any less real than Buddy's or Maddie's or Irene's or Frankie's? It gets to this question about appearances. You know, there's that scene when their mother is dying and Teddy, like, before he takes them to the hospital, he wants them to take baths and, like, get dressed nicely and then bring them to the hospital to say goodbye. And she dies before they can do that. And Irene says, you know, Teddy's problem is always that he cared too much about appearances. And so we then lost this, like, really important chance to say goodbye to our mother. But I guess
that was really sad.
Which is really sad. But I think that for me, the book ultimately kind of endorses this idea that appearances are meaningful, that it's that often, like, the what you project or who people believe you to be based on your appearance is just as real as anything else.
I will say, it does seem to me like Teddy, who is always very sharply dressed and very aware of the image he's presenting, is much more successful than Frankie. I guess there is the sort of terrible accident that happens to
yeah.
to him. He keeps calling it his accident, which is why I think of it that way. But apart from that, when he interacts with Nick and anyone else in the mobster world, he seems to really get through it very smoothly. Whereas like Frankie just does not at all. It's just like a catastrophe every time he tries to like go in and like be the cool guy that he wants to be, you know? So I agree with you. I think there is an element of like the successfulness of the appearance of being that successful person kind of makes you that successful person.
I'm not sure what my connection is exactly, but I'm thinking about Joshua and Irene having this AOL chat romance. Mm-hmm. And it's an early version of something that we now have 20 years of experience and discourse with. But that was a pretty early, like, hangouts where you would chat with people. They don't much predate AOL. And in that realm, Irene's so thrilled by Joshua when she doesn't have to see him and interact with him in person. Like I'm just thinking of this as a kind of appearance, or maybe it's the absence of appearance, but it's something about his representation of himself is all that she needs. And she almost prefers it to having to interact with some 3D more fallible version of him.
Yeah. Like she almost doesn't want the reality, the honesty. Which is, you wouldn't think of like an online relationship, like that's sort of the pitfall of it when we think about it, but that's actually what she's looking for. You're right.
Exactly.
I loved her interview scene where she figured out what was going on and kind of took them down. It felt like that was actually the moment for me where I was like, here's Irene's superpower, like being used in a Wonder Woman kind of way. I was really proud of her for that.
Well, what did you guys think about the ending? Because I'm just thinking about kind of happy endings and the way that I feel like this novel, it doesn't give us kind of a traditional happy ending, but I think like the characters are kind of on the right trajectory with their lives at last. And I wanted to talk more broadly about, you have this novel where for much of it, we are told that like the end of the world is coming. That's Buddy is telling us like the end of the world is going to happen on this date, and the novel is edging closer. The headings of the sections of the book are moving us to the months where it's going to happen. And in the meantime, Buddy is doing all of these crazy things like digging holes and putting metal over the windows in the basement. And we don't know why. We don't know exactly what the end of the world is going to look like. And, you know, and then comes the kind of denouement. And I wondered what you made of it. Or how you felt about it.
Something I really liked about the ending of this book was I felt like the discussions after, you know, so the Buddy's predicting and knows about this one really climactic, dramatic event that's going to happen, and all of his preparations are leading up to it. And I thought that that event itself was pretty well done and exciting and fun. And then I think we're talking about what's the feeling we're given in the next and last 20 pages of the book. And I felt like it was the right amount of peace, happiness, satisfaction. It wasn't too much. It wasn't that the climactic event made them all millionaires. It was that they got freed from something, and then they were going to be able to live more simply after that and without the crushing weight of either their reputation or their powers or of this knowledge. And it reminded me of a moment in a couple of slightly less highbrow texts. Terminator 2, the last image of that movie is a car traveling down a dark highway. And the voiceover is basically saying, this is the first time that I haven't known what's going to happen next. And I'm really excited about it. Now, in order to make money, they ended up making Terminator 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And so they kind of take that away. But there's at least this moment right before the credits where you get to feel like, oh, Sarah Connor is going to get to live without this terrible knowledge waiting in front of her. And I feel like that's what, to me, that's what the last 15 pages of this book felt like. It felt like, oh, I really like these people. They've worked really hard, and now they get to take a breath or exhale maybe.
Yeah, and they're not counting down to something anymore. That's really interesting because I actually, that's what I did with my future character. The book I wrote about her, it ends with her like suddenly free and suddenly not knowing, like she's had all this time, like figuring out what's coming ahead and trying to like get to that particular ending that she's looking for. And I think there is something liberating about suddenly not, just not knowing. And I think that's kind of how you feel at the end of a lot of books, right? Like you don't know what's going to happen next, but you kind of, if the author does it right, you're left feeling like, but it's all going to work out. Like they keep saying in this book, it's all going to work out.
Yeah.
And I love how also it coincides with the end of Maureen's letters, which was one of my favorite things in the book. I love that he kept getting letters from her all through the years of like, here's what's going on now. And here's what I know is happening to you. And here's my advice about it. And I thought that was such a beautiful touch.
Yeah. And that in a way I was thinking of her as kind of like a perfect, almost sort of Mrs. Ramsey kind of character, where she, like, I know that they miss her and I know that she loves them, but in some ways they need to get out from the shadow of her perfect mothering as well. And so she kind of lets them go with that last letter, like her letter to Maddie and then her last letter to Teddy are basically, okay, I'm done predicting your future. Now go ahead and do stuff on your own.
What you have to say about, you know, the ends of those movies and books where the sense of like, okay, now I can go off and make choices is very literally applicable to Buddy, right? Who, after his power is destroyed, you know, says he doesn't know what's going to happen the next day. He's sitting at the restaurant having an order from the menu and he doesn't know what he's ordered because for the first time he doesn't know, isn't already like a memory of what he ordered. So he has to look through the menu and choose. And that's both terrifying but also liberating. And to me, you know, what I love about this book is like, it operates as like a metaphor, but also on a literal level, right? So it's not as if they're saying like, but he didn't have this future telling power and it was all just a metaphor.
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, it is kind of a metaphor for coming of age and this sense that as an adult, you have to make all of these choices. And of course, on some level you want to, on some level that's freeing to not have to be under the thumb of your parents anymore. And on some level, it's very scary because what if you make all of the wrong choices? And to me, you know, this kind of was a coming of age for Buddy. And I think it ties into something we haven't talked about, which is Buddy's secret, you know, regarding his sexuality, and which was handled, I thought, very deftly in the book, kind of almost dropped in a way that, you know, was it didn't make a huge deal about. But to me, this, you know, I think part of Buddy feeling so unmoored and so unable to kind of become an adult. And this, again, is really not fully developed in the book, so maybe I'm making too much of it. But I feel like it's his kind of coming to terms with his own desires and, you know, wondering about acceptance, both, you know, his own acceptance of himself and his family's acceptance of him. And the book kind of ends with him taking those steps toward accepting who he is. And I think with the family also taking those steps, like he's always been the baby and they always ultimately sort of treat him like the baby, and maybe that's what's kind of kept him in that space as much as his own powers and what that does to him.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think also it's a coming of age story for Maddie too. We haven't really talked about him, and you know, obviously, I mean, he's the actual adolescent in this book, and I just thought, speaking of like superpowers as a metaphor, I thought his ability to like leave his body was such a perfect like metaphor for being a teenager and how much you just want to like be out of your body sometimes. Everything about it is frustrating. You know, they had a few moments in there that I thought were just perfectly expressed, like, oh, poor teenage boys, you know? And over the course of the book, he has to kind of come to terms with it. And he does, I think, in a really great way.
Even Irene, it's a kind of coming of age for her. I mean, as much as she is already, you know, in her 30s and a mother, you know, she was a very young mother and it still feels like she is like trying to find her way and her place in the world. And in the course of the book, as she finds a career and she finds a relationship and a relationship that she can actually have in a real adult way with all the complications of it, she too is kind of coming of age.
In fact, and not just the relationship, but also the female friendship. I want to say thank you to the author for including the friendship between Irene and Graciela. Like, I like that.
You're making me realize that something really worked in this book that I often feel forced in other books, which is all of the characters, all of the main characters have a similar shift in their self-understanding at about the same time, but not in a way that didn't feel gimmicky to me. Because you left out Frankie, who I think admits vulnerability for the first time to his wife, and so isn't acting like he's going to come up with another scheme to save everything, but in fact is admitting that he has messed up. And somehow the way the plots come together allow most of the people to have some kind of self-insight, but about slightly different things. And they don't even all know it about each other. It's not like they weren't actively collaborating and then suddenly all said to each other, you know what I just realized? And yet their plots are interwoven well enough that essentially the big shootout event allows most of them to say, oh yeah, you know what? I want to move past what held me back before.
Yeah,
I really like this book. I was worried about 2/3 of the way through that there were too many things going on and that I was going to be dissatisfied with how they got resolved. And instead, I felt like, no, the pace quickened a little bit in the way that it does towards a dramatic climax, but not too much. It didn't feel like there were 10 pages in which 100 pages of resolution had to happen. And I really like a book that mixes actual magic with skepticism and dubiousness and trickery.
Me too.
Me too.
And with real family drama and like very deep emotional like character problems.
I mean, that was what I loved so much about it, was like it was in some ways like it was about this family, and like their interactions seemed completely realistic to me. You know, the sibling relationships, the father children relationships, and they each have their own individual relationships, both among each other and with their dad and their mom, and they all felt really true and developed to me. And the fact that that could be kind of combined with this story of supernatural powers and simultaneously this like mafia, you know, caper felt unique and really compelling to me.
And can I also just add, while we're talking about metaphors and superpowers, the fact that the 7-year-old twins can set things on fire, like
yeah, I love that at the end, right? When he's like, okay, just, you know, that thing you're not supposed to do, do it. And the car bursts into flames.
Like when that first time we hear about it, when he's like, don't burn anything down. I think they were 3 at the time. You're like, yeah, that's, or maybe that's when they're 7, but between 3 and 7 is when you kind of feel like they're going to set things on fire.
Right.
Just by anything. So, and especially with twins, that makes it even more perfect.
All right. Well, Tui and Alfie, it has been so fun talking with you. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sid. Thank you for having us read this book. It was awesome.
Yeah. I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM. Next up, New Haven librarian Margaret Gergis reviews 2 teen graphic novels from Sarah Anderson's A Sarah Scribbles Collection.
Hi, I'm Margaret Gergis, teen librarian at the New Haven Free Public Library. I'm here to review and recommend 2 graphic novels recently added to our young adult collection, Adulthood is a Myth and Big Mushy Happy Lump, both by Sarah Anderson. Both are part of the Sarah Scribbles Collection. In Adulthood is a Myth, Anderson contemplates the so-called pleasures of being, or becoming, an adult. Important issues such as clothing yourself. When exactly should I wash those jeans? Why are the clothes that look the ugliest my favorites to wear? And of course, how is it possible when clothing shopping for a tiny size to be falling off, but a larger size to be way too tight? She writes about the weird superpowers possessed by bookworms, and what exercise looks like when we plan it versus when we actually do it. She explores our innermost reactions to socially awkward situations, and our feelings when someone asks an inordinately stupid question such as, "How's your final going?" In Big Mushy Happy Lump, Anderson continues contemplations on life, focusing on the horrors of interacting in society when basically all you'd really like to do is to be left alone with your 300 most favorite books, and maybe a cat. Tackling such issues as self-esteem, complete with hilarious roller coaster illustrations, financial self-control, the nuances of communication and miscommunication, and of course, the secret to a perfect selfie, Anderson looks at our messy, wonderful, timeless yet modern lives and forces readers to take a breath, look around, and realize that being yourself truly is okay. If you are an introvert, have ever faced social anxiety, or like me, overthink every comment you have ever heard or made, then you need to read these books. For more teen books and programs, come visit the library's Teen Center at the Ives Main Library at 133 Elm Street. You can find more information on our website at www.nhfpl.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. As a reminder, all books discussed on Book Talk can always be found at the New Haven Free Public Library.
Thanks, Margaret. On our next show, airing July 12th, we'll be talking about the novel Who is Rich? First with the author, Matthew Clam, and then with my fellow readers, Annie Toms and Jessica Sager. I've been waiting for this novel ever since Matthew Clam published his story collection, Sam the Cat, 17 years ago, and it doesn't disappoint. Make sure to tune in. As ever, you can share your thoughts on this episode of Book Talk or any other on Facebook or Twitter, or by emailing me directly at booktalkwnhh@gmail.com. You can listen to old episodes or see what's coming up on our website, booktalkradio.net. Until next time, happy reading. Thank you.